Welcome to the Immigration Issues Explored Donor Conference Call. My name is Sylvia, and I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Eric Cohen. Mr. Cohen, you may begin.
Thank you, Sylvia, and welcome, and thank you all for attending today. As Sylvia said, my name is Eric Cohen. I'm the executive director at the IRC. I'm also an attorney. I want to thank all of you so much for supporting the IRC. You're the reason why we can do all the work we do, and so thanks to all of you. As Sylvia said, this call is being recorded, and we will share it out later with you all and others who couldn't make the call today. I want to start by saying a few things about the IRC's work, and then I'll introduce Samir Hafiz, who is our co-presenter today, and then I'll set the stage for our talk. So, as you may know, the IRC's job is to help protect immigrants and keep them in the United States, together with their families, and help them thrive here. We do this by building the capacity of the field of immigration lawyers, pro bono attorneys, and nonprofit organizations, so they know how to help immigrants better. We also engage in policy and advocacy work on a national, state, and local level, and we conduct immigration leadership training, outreach, and education to build the capacity of immigrant communities to advocate on their own behalf. All of you help us do this work. So let's talk about today. As we all know, the Trump administration has relentless focus on dismantling our immigration system, including increasing mass detention, family separation, and changes to asylum and naturalization policies. The Trump administration has been able to fast-track immigration-related policy changes because of immigration policy decisions made by previous administrations and because of the work that his administration is doing today. Today is the third donor call in a series of three. Over the past 2 months, we had the other two telebriefings. The discussion during the first telebriefing, which was in September, covered how the six presidents before President Trump were guilty of many horrific policies directly towards and negatively impacting immigrants in unfair and previously unseen ways. These included instances such as Ronald Reagan's efforts to increase mass incarceration and push back against Central American asylum cases during the 1980s, when asylum was more important than ever because of the civil wars and terror in Central America. It included George H.W. Bush's reluctance to assist students pushing reforms during the Tiananmen Square fiasco. It included Bill Clinton's draconian changes to the immigration laws in 1996 that paved the way for the accelerated detention and deportations happening today. And George W. Bush's push to increase immigration raids and deportations and his administration's racist and Islamophobic treatment of Muslim immigrants. And all the way to President Obama, who became the, quote, deporter-in-chief because of the record number of deportations for which he was responsible. Then, just a couple weeks ago, we had our second telebriefing that was led by Sharon Hing and Dilong Hing. That discussion specifically detailed some of the most dastardly changes that the Trump administration is implementing on a daily basis, such as his drastic decrease in refugee admissions, who are among those most in need of the United States help, his Muslim ban, the increase in detention of immigrants, and especially young immigrants, the destruction of the country's asylum system, the push to eliminate the opportunities for poor people to come to the United States, and many other racist and xenophobic policies. Today, we're going to focus specifically on the Trump administration's attacks on one of the most precious status that is available to anyone, that is United States citizenship. Yes, the Trump administration is even attacking citizenship by putting up significant roadblocks to the naturalization process, stepping up efforts to denaturalize people, that is to strip U.S. citizens of their status as naturalized citizens, and even revoking U.S. citizen, United States passports. All of these are shameful actions in which this administration is engaging. To help me with the discussion today, we are so lucky to have the IRC's Director of Policy, Samir Hafiz. Samir leads our Washington, D.C. office and is our policy director and an attorney for the IRC. She leads the IRC's policy team, which engages in policy advocacy at the federal, state, and local levels in Washington, D.C., California, and Texas. Prior to joining the IRC, previous roles that Samir has held include the Advocacy Director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the Director of Policy and Campaigns at the Rights Working Group, Senior Staff Attorney with the Legal Momentum Immigrant Women Program, and also an attorney with the Immigration Law Unit of the Legal Aid Society of New York. So before I introduce Samira and have her talk, I want to talk a little bit about the current landscape for naturalization and citizenship. So first, what is naturalization and why is it so important? Just to step back. So naturalization is the process by which an immigrant can become a United States citizen. Mostly, it's only for green card holders, that is lawful permanent residents, who can become U.S. citizens, and they have to go through a process where they're here for a certain number of years, they can show good moral character, and they have to show a certain level of English and understanding of U.S. history and civics. Why is naturalization so important? Oh, by the way, approximately 700,000 to 900,000 people a year apply for naturalization, and approximately almost that many, about 90% of them, actually naturalize. There has been a huge uptick since Donald Trump won the Republican nomination and since he has become president. So why is naturalization so important? Well, citizenship increases individual earnings, creates billions in additional tax revenue, and increases the country's gross domestic product. Citizenship provides safety and security to immigrants. It helps them apply for their loved ones to come to the United States and reunify their families, and it allows them to run for political office as well as hold other important jobs that non-citizens cannot hold. Additionally, citizenship is fundamental to our democracy. It entitles people to vote and become more rooted in the United States. You know, in July of 2013, I was fortunate enough to speak on a panel at one of the very first events at the President George W. Bush's Presidential Library and Museum in Dallas, Texas. The event's focus was on United States citizenship, specifically naturalization. The event also included a naturalization swearing-in ceremony at which President George W. Bush spoke. His speech actually had a lasting impact on me. At one particularly powerful moment in the speech, President Bush told the soon-to-be American citizens, quote, "In a few moments, we will share the same title, a title that has meant more to me than any other, and I've had a lot of titles. And this title would be Citizen of the United States." But the Trump administration is undermining the naturalization process. And by doing this, the administration is demonstrating yet another way that is attempting to build an invisible but very sturdy wall that keeps immigrants out of the United States and makes their lives here harder. Additionally, they're building a real barrier to voting, and in fact, they're committing an act of voter suppression. As much as George W. Bush was an advocate of the naturalization process, and as much as Obama, the Obama administration, was an advocate of the naturalization process, this president and his administration are foes of the naturalization process. So that's just background, and I want to turn it over to Samira and ask her a little bit about the current administration's attempt at denaturalizing citizens, or essentially taking away their citizenship from naturalized citizens. And I know that some people have read about this in the newspaper, but wondering, Samira, if you could talk just for a little bit about what exactly is denaturalization, how is it happening and why, and what do you think about it? What's going on?
Thanks so much, Eric, for that introduction. And yes, as Eric mentioned, denaturalization strips Americans of their citizenship. It completely destabilizes families, sows fear and uncertainty in immigrant communities, and in this current climate adds to the chilling effect legal permanent residents might feel when considering whether to naturalize. So it's an extremely drastic step. The exact scope of the government's denaturalization efforts is difficult to decipher because the Trump administration has been opaque about their efforts and have reported different numbers at different times. In a recently published report by the Open Society Justice Initiative called "On Making Americans," the authors conduct an in-depth examination of 168 denaturalization cases initiated since the Trump presidency that reveal that current cases disproportionately impact citizens based on national origin, with the highest numbers from Mexico, Haiti, and Nigeria, all countries that President Trump has publicly demeaned. The New York Times has reported that 10% of civil denaturalization cases are of Americans originally from Yemen, Somalia, and Iran, countries also impacted by the Muslim ban. And those countries make up only 1% of the foreign-born population. Traditionally, denaturalization was used in rare cases to target war criminals trying to escape prosecution. In the Trump administration, three times as many civil denaturalization cases were filed than the average of the past eight administrations. This staggering increase was also reflected in the rise in criminal denaturalization cases filed by the government. The Trump administration has also sought to drastically increase the budget for denaturalization. In its 2019 budget request, the government proposed transferring over $200 million from the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for denaturalization and other immigration enforcement measures. In its 2020 budget, the Department of Justice projected a continuing increase in its denaturalization caseload. In a recent proposed rule that I think Eric's going to talk about more, related to fees for immigration applications, the Department of Homeland Security argues that fees for immigration benefits are to be exponentially increased to provide more funding for immigration enforcement, including for denaturalization. Looking more closely at some of the Americans who have been targeted by the efforts may be surprising. The Department of Justice has argued that its denaturalization work is about addressing grave threats to national security and public safety. But take the case of Mr. Khan from Florida, which this case has been extensively reported in The Intercept. Mr. Khan came to the U.S. from Pakistan in 1991 when he was detained in Los Angeles because of questions about his passport and put into deportation proceedings. Mr. Khan at the time spoke no English and was not provided with an interpreter. He was able to secure a lawyer while in detention who helped him file an asylum application. The lawyer used Mr. Khan's cellmate as an interpreter, who was an Indian national who did not speak the same language as him, and advised Mr. Khan to use a different name on his application. Mr. Khan never received a copy of the asylum application filed on his behalf and was later released, and he moved to Florida. An important note is that Mr. Khan's lawyer was also suspended for misconduct. In the intervening years, Mr. Khan lived and worked in Florida as a truck driver. He met someone, a U.S. citizen, who later became his wife, and together they had children and are now grandparents. Through his marriage, Mr. Khan secured a green card but did not disclose his previous asylum application. And, in fact, he had no knowledge that he had a prior order of deportation in connection with his asylum application. In 2017, Mr. Khan's case was flagged as a result of Operation Janus, which sought to digitize fingerprints collected prior to the department's digitization. And the Department of Justice commenced a denaturalization case against him. Mr. Khan's current attorney argued that his client's situation is a result of a lack of familiarity and knowledge about the immigration process. In any case, the efforts to denaturalize Mr. Khan have destabilized his entire family and raised serious questions about how prosecuting an American who naturalized in 2006 protects our national security and public safety. The suggestion that he is a threat and should be prosecuted fits into a larger narrative about immigrants and their threatening presence in the United States that's been espoused by the Trump administration. As I mentioned before, the government has reported different numbers at various times in terms of quantifying their denaturalization efforts. They stated that DHS intends to refer 1,600 cases to DOJ for prosecution. In the 2019 budget request, DHS stated it intends to review 700,000 files of American citizens. In 2018, then-USCIS Director Francis Cisna announced the creation of a new office, the Denaturalization Task Force, and the recruitment of new attorneys. And DHS has also requested funds for 300 new agents to investigate fraud in connection with denaturalization caseloads. Looking at all the numbers, the government could be scrutinizing over 1 million files of U.S. citizens. Aside from the troubling expansiveness of these inquiries, it is important to think about denaturalization in the context of all of the other efforts of the Trump administration around immigration policy, which serve a narrative that our immigration system creates a path for terrorists and criminals to endanger real Americans. And this narrative goes against everything the ILRC stands for. In addition, these efforts create two classes of U.S. citizens, and those that are naturalized are never really American enough. They can never feel secure and as though they truly belong. And as we mentioned before, this really is creates a chilling effect on those seeking naturalization and on civic participation generally. It's also a sad comment on the priorities of our government, which is to comb through files of Americans rather than address the backlogs and processing delays in the immigration system. And just so you know, the ILRC has been working with many partners to fight these efforts and advance a different narrative about immigration. Along with the ACLU, we convene a strategy group in D.C. to coordinate efforts to fight denaturalization and develop a policy strategy. The ILRC also created an issue brief and talking points. We also engage in capacity building around this issue. We set a training, webinar, practice advisory, and other information for practitioners. And we've also led thinking with partners at law firms on how to secure pro bono representation for Americans facing denaturalization. One major concern is that there are a lack of procedural safeguards in these cases. So, for example, in civil denaturalization cases, there is no right to counsel, and 25% of individuals have no representation. And there is also no statute of limitation in these cases.
Thanks, Amir. Wow, that's a whole bunch. We really appreciate that. So I know this is just a thought question, but why do you think the Trump administration is doing this, is increasing this denaturalization work? Is it a move to play to his base? Is it to try and keep people from voting? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's probably all of those things. It's part of their view on immigration and immigrants and the immigration system. They've furthered this narrative of immigration as a threat to America rather than something that enriches our country and makes it more robust and diverse. In addition, you raised this question about voting earlier, and I think it is logical to assume that these efforts fit into a systemic strategy to narrow the voting power, particularly of people of color. And we've seen that there is a very concerted and organized effort by the right to do this through voter disenfranchisement efforts and other extensive voter suppression measures. And as you're going to talk about later in the call, there are serious backlogs and naturalization backlogs and processing delays, which has made it harder for a new batch of voters to become part of the voting bloc. So it does seem like it is an effort to decrease the number of voters, especially those who are people of color. And I think that the idea that even though you are a citizen, you can't feel secure and at home, it's also part of a larger strategy around that, of using the systems that we have to make immigrants, even those that have naturalized, feel less secure, less at home, make them feel unsafe and always looking over their back. And that's just one part of many of the other efforts we've seen since the Trump administration has come into power.
Right. And is my understanding, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the Obama administration started some of this increase in denaturalization and Trump has kind of taken it to the next level. Is that would you characterize that as being correct?
Yes, that is correct. So there was a program called Operation Janus, which is the program that Mr. Khan, the story that I discussed, that's how he came to the attention of the department. And it was a program to look at old immigration applications where the fingerprints were not digitized and compare them with the digital records they had and bring everything up to date. And so it was an effort to see who had filed previous applications and if those could be targets for denaturalization. So this effort to really look into denaturalization started with the Obama administration, and it created the tools for the Trump administration to really take it to the next level as they did. And the rise in the numbers of both civil and criminal denaturalizations are unprecedented since Trump took office.
Right. And so civil denaturalization obviously is starts in federal district court, but it's a civil proceeding where people have the right to an attorney but not a paid-for attorney by the government. And criminal actually is a criminal proceeding, right? And they are allowed a free lawyer, a federal public defender. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And both of them, one, the criminal can not only cause you to lose your status as a citizen, but eventually deported, but it can also cause you to go to jail, I assume. That's right?
That's correct. There are criminal penalties associated with the criminal prosecution.
Right. So while we're on the topic of losing your citizenship, and before we get to the topic of naturalization, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Maybe you could talk just for a few minutes about this rampant effort to take away people's United States passports, which I don't know much about, but I've read a little bit about and seems to be really drastic. Can you share a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Yes, you're referring to passport revocations, and this is an issue also that is emerging and that we're in the process of learning more about. But it is another way to destabilize American families. So withholding a passport doesn't invalidate citizenship, but does signal that an individual will not be able to live as a U.S. citizen, and for those that have naturalized may lead to denaturalization. The Department of State has the discretion to revoke or deny passports, and impacted Americans have pretty inadequate remedies once that happens. The Open Society Justice Initiative report that I mentioned also did a deep examination of passport revocations and identified three main types that are going on now. One is of Yemeni Americans, the second is of Americans at the southern border, and the third is Americans that are flagged through secure communities, which is an immigration enforcement tool, or similar immigration enforcement programs. The State Department's Office of the Inspector General conducted an investigation in 2016 following a whistleblower report that Yemeni Americans going to the U.S. Embassy in Yemen were having their passports confiscated. So they would go for regular consular services like registering a birth, and then they would face an accusation that they naturalized under false pretenses and would often be threatened and interrogated. Eventually, their passports would be confiscated. So in a one-month period, the OIG found that 31 passports were confiscated, and they recognized that this understates the actual numbers and found also that there is no central system within the State Department to track passport revocations. So they did estimate that 1,500 are revoked each year. The State Department also found in these cases there were no procedural protections in place for Yemeni Americans facing revocation. So even though it doesn't have the legal effect of denaturalization when a passport is revoked, for an American abroad who had a passport revoked, it de facto does the same thing because they're living in limbo and do not have the option to leave the country as an American. At the southern border, many American citizens are part of transnational families. The Washington Post reported, and the Open Society report also verifies, that there's been a significant peak in passport revocations in midwife cases. So those are cases of Americans born on American soil but outside of a hospital with the assistance of local midwives. To challenge these revocations, Americans must affirmatively litigate in federal court. There is no right to counsel, and these cases are complex. Lawyers from the region representing those who have had their passports revoked note that the government has become more aggressive in defending these cases, and it is not uncommon for the government to lose after lengthy and expensive trials. The ethos before was to try to settle those cases, but since the Trump administration, they haven't settled, and they've been more aggressive in defending them. The report identified a 64% increase in the number of civil actions filed after 2017 since Trump took office. And then the final bucket is through secure communities, which through that program, DHS and the FBI databases are linked. And it's a way for ICE to look at folks with immigration records. And they have been operating under an assumption that individuals with no immigration records should be placed on immigration holds. So not having an immigration record is also a strong indicator that an individual is a U.S. citizen. And so there have been cases of U.S. citizens with immigration holds placed on them that where ICE has refused to consider an individual's passport as proof of citizenship. So these revocations and confiscations are part of a larger effort that really attacks the security of American citizenship and has the effect of destabilizing families, forcing them to live in fear and uncertainty.
Well, great. Thank you. The revocation stuff is really quite scary. All of it's scary, but that's especially scary as well, to just take someone's passport, which might be their only proof of citizenship, away from them, especially when they're abroad. So thanks for that. Maybe we should talk a little bit about naturalization now.
That's great. We've heard a lot about how the Trump administration is negatively impacting the actual naturalization process, causing backlogs and making it harder for people to naturalize. Could you briefly talk about what the state of naturalization is today and why?
Sure, thanks. And so as you know, as the listeners know, we'll be going back and forth during this entire phone call. So once again, I just want to remind people what naturalization is. Naturalization is a process that allows for a lawful permanent resident, or green card holder, that is, to become a United States citizen and have all the rights and responsibilities of any other United States citizen, except for one, which is a naturalized citizen cannot become president of the United States, as our former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, knows so well, because he probably would have run for president at some point in time. But our nation's naturalization program is really in a state of dysfunction. And as Samira alluded to before, the USCIS, or the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is the body that adjudicates naturalization cases, they are not adequately, fairly, and efficiently processing naturalization applications. And instead of remedying this situation, the Trump administration's policies have exacerbated unmanageable backlogs, and the wait to naturalize has doubled. It has ballooned to unacceptable levels, and the result is that naturalization applicants and their families are suffering. Remember all the positive aspects of naturalization. You can get better jobs, you can vote, it helps with home ownership, it helps create more for the economy, and it helps you bring in and immigrate your family members. So that is those results are being delayed. So in 2015, most people, once they applied for naturalization, most people, it took a little less than 6 months, 5.8 months to naturalize, to be sworn in. In 2017, that doubled almost. And as of this year, it's over 10 months on average. And in some jurisdictions, like Miami, Dallas, New York, and others, the processing time has stretched for some people to nearly 2 years. So huge delays.
Wow, that is disturbing, to say the least. What is causing these delays, and how can they be remedied?
So first, I want to say that it's not all Trump's fault, the Trump administration's fault. The Obama administration had a lot to do with causing some of the backlogs. There were some mistakes made by the Trump administration. There was a huge technology mistake, which caused a backlog of several hundred thousand. And probably the biggest mistake is the Trump administration didn't adequately foresee how many additional people would be applying for naturalization due to Donald Trump winning the Republican nomination and then eventually becoming president. And so starting with the Obama administration and continuing with the Trump administration, the Office of Citizenship didn't really prepare for a 30-plus percent increase in the number of people applying for citizenship. So that's what originally spiked the backlogs. And then what has caused them to be exacerbated is the fact that, and now we have a backlog of well over 700,000 people waiting to naturalize. What's caused it to be exacerbated are several reasons. And first is the fact that this administration has not prioritized addressing the backlog and has not dedicated sufficient resources to clearing it. So in previous years, Republican or Democrat, including George W. Bush and including Obama, when there was a visibly long backlog, USCIS made significant progress to clear those backlogs because they viewed it as a priority. They paid people overtime, they brought in temp workers, they moved people from busy slow offices to busy offices. But sadly, none of this is happening to an extent under the Trump administration. And in fact, just the opposite. Recently, USCIS made an ask of all of its volunteers who are adjudicating cases like naturalization, made an ask if any of them wanted to go down to the southern border and help with that. So they wanted to get volunteers to move away from helping with naturalization to go towards enforcement. And of course, the proof's in the pudding, as Samira mentioned about the $200 million the Trump administration is asking for to be transferred from adjudications to ICE and ICE, which is enforcement. So there's not a will by this administration. Second, this administration spends an enormous amount of time and effort on re-adjudicating determinations in a naturalization case. But these determinations were already made, thus unduly delaying the process for naturalization. Last March, we surveyed our partners across the nation, and we have about 140 partners across the country who are helping people apply for naturalization. We surveyed them about changes in practices in naturalization. Most of those surveyed reported that naturalization interviews are lasting longer, and in fact, approximately lasting twice as long as in the past, thus contributing to the backlog. If it used to take a half an hour to have a naturalization interview, which is a long time for one, now it might take up to an hour. And therefore, you can only obviously interview half as many people during the day. Our partners reported that USCIS adjudicators are also viewing naturalization applicants with more suspicion. And in one case that we heard about, an adjudicator asked for proof of marriage even though the couple already has children together and the marriage was already determined valid by USCIS during the green card interview and then after the green card interview during another interview. So now they're asking for a third proof that people were married. Often adjudicators ask for applicants to provide information outside the scope of their naturalization applications, thus delaying the adjudication. And in fact, in another recent case, one of our partners reported that an 82-year-old Iranian woman applied for naturalization. During the interview, the adjudicator decided to revisit the details of her entire asylum case, which is how she got her green card, specifically about the persecution that she suffered in Iran, including the trauma she suffered, even though those details were completely vetted during her asylum interview 9 years earlier. Well, as you can bet, she broke down and was unable to complete the interview, causing her to be denied naturalization. So these are some of the reasons why this backlog is being exacerbated, and the Trump administration is obviously doing nothing to take care of alleviating the backlog, but is wreaking havoc on the process instead.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks also for sharing those examples. It really demonstrates how the impact it has on people's lives. And for those of us that follow immigration policy, I know this is a hot topic, especially this week. Can you tell us about the fees for naturalization and fee waivers and how the Trump administration's policies are impacting the ability of poor people to apply?
Yeah, that's a good question. Essentially what the Trump administration is not only going after immigrants, but they're really going after poor immigrants. And so when I started helping people apply for naturalization, the cost was $95. Now, today, the naturalization costs, the government fee is $725. And if you think about that, you think at federal minimum wage, it would take someone, federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, it would take someone 100 hours to make enough money to apply for naturalization. That's not even counting the amount of money that would be taken out in taxes, in Social Security, Medicare, or the person having to save to buy clothing, food, etc. There is, as of now, a very fair fee waiver program that the Obama administration implemented. It's only for very poor people, generally people who are about 150% of the poverty guidelines, which means they're pretty poor, or people who are receiving certain public benefits, which also indicates that they're poor. Just recently, meaning last Friday, the Trump administration came out with a memo, a press release actually, explaining that they're going to put out regulations that will make it much harder for poor people, working class people, even middle class people to qualify for naturalization. Because what they're doing is they're going to completely eliminate the fee waiver. Now think about that. Fee waiver for poor people, they're going to completely eliminate it, even though close to 40% of the people apply for a fee waiver. Tens of thousands of people will not be able to become U.S. citizens because of this fee waiver, because of the elimination of the fee waiver. Additionally, they're proposing to increase the cost to an applicant from $725 to $1,170, which is a 60% increase. At $1,170, that would take the federal minimum wage earner 160 hours to make enough money in order to pay for naturalization. That is a month of work in order to pay for naturalization. We're going to see a huge decrease in the number of people applying for naturalization, especially in the number of working class people and of poor people. Essentially, what this administration is doing is not only increasing their promise or coming through with their promise of being racist and xenophobic, but they're also implementing essentially a wealth test to naturalization, one of the most coveted processes in American history. We've had naturalization since, I believe, 1790. And now this administration is essentially going to gut it by making it out of reach for poor and working class people. Might as well put on the naturalization application, poor people need not apply. This is only for wealthy people to apply. So this is really drastic. Just to give you some scope, we run something called the New Americans Campaign, also called the NAC, and that is the largest national naturalization collaboration in the history of the United States. We work in 21 cities where we support lawyers and paralegals from nonprofits applying for helping people apply for naturalization. We, over the last 8 years, have helped 435,000 people complete their naturalization applications, and approximately 40% of those people have applied for fee waivers. This is a very big deal, because if there weren't fee waivers, and if the costs were $1,170, you can darn well bet a significant number of those 435,000 people would not have applied for naturalization. So it is really a drastic situation.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'd love to, for you to have a chance to talk a little bit more about what the ILRC is doing today to encourage citizenship applications and overcome the barriers of the Trump administration.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Samira. So really, we're working on three different fronts to help with naturalization. The first front is we've engaged in significant outreach and education to the immigrant community to encourage them to apply for naturalization. We do this through our 21 sites that I spoke about in the New Americans campaign. We do it through some ethnic media as well. We also do it through outreach flyers and information education techniques. Second, as I mentioned, the New Americans campaign is the biggest collaboration of naturalization in the history of the United States. And we're helping on the ground. Our partners, our 140 partners, are helping applicants apply for naturalization in 21 different sites all over the country. We've helped so far 435,000 people apply, as I mentioned before. And the ILRC is continuing our work to develop and push out best practices and train folks so that the people on the ground, that is the attorneys and the paralegals at nonprofits, those people on the ground can help green card holders apply for naturalization in the most effective and efficient ways, and to try to combat the Trump administration in helping people get over these bumps in the road that the administration is engaging with. Also, we've been engaged in some policy and litigation work. We are working with a governmental relations group in Washington, D.C., called the Raven Group, really a lobbyist group, to make sure that Congress understands the present state of the naturalization process and the desperate need for the House of Representatives to step in to provide the oversight that's necessary to get the USCIS back in line with its true naturalization mission. In this vein, some of you might know that in July I testified before the House Judiciary Committee, the Subcommittee on Immigration and Citizenship, and the focus of our testimony was specifically on naturalization and the backlogs at USCIS and the policies and processes that have caused those backlogs. In my testimony, we gave 10 different suggestions to the administration and 7 to Congress as to ways that they could help not completely eliminate, but help push back against the backlogs and to decrease the backlogs. And last, we've recently been involved in a lawsuit with the City of Seattle and 4 naturalization legal service providers to sue the Trump administration on blocking fee waiver changes from taking effect. We are actually the client in this case. A wonderful organization is representing us. So that's another way in which we have encouraged citizenship and pushed back against these the backlog that the Trump administration is exacerbating. So it's outreach, policy and litigation, and application assistance. So those are some of the things that we've been engaging in naturalization. I want to go back to Samira, and maybe I could ask you a question, Samira.
Sure.
A lot of people are upset because it seems like the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, the agency whose job it is to give benefits to immigrants, green cards, work authorization, naturalization, asylum, that organization seems to be transitioning from a benefits-granting agency to one that erects barriers and acts like an enforcement agency. What's going on here? What are your thoughts about that? And is this new during the Trump administration?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I agree that the USCIS has, throughout the past couple of years, morphed into an enforcement agency, and that was not the original design of the Department of Homeland Security, which very purposely separated the enforcement arm from the customer service and benefits arm, which was USCIS. And I think the most kind of jarring indication of that was when it changed its mission statement to remove any reference to customer service and actually mentions under the USCIS mission statement that something about securing the homeland. And we see, you know, through policy changes that the USCIS and the Department of Homeland Security has created ways without getting changes in law from Congress to use policies to really erect significant barriers that do have a similar effect to changing the law. One of the things that we see are funneling applicants into removal proceedings, so people that apply for adjustment or naturalization getting placed into removal proceedings. And then there are all kinds of other efforts that we've seen that are quite surprising, social media monitoring of applicants, the whole discussion about extreme vetting. I think it is fair to say the USCIS has become much more closely coordinated with ICE and has actually become a pseudo enforcement agency.
Yeah, that's hard, especially with Ken Cuccinelli running the organization. He seems to be as xenophobic, as anti-immigrant as they come. Any input before we close out about what our audience can do to push back against the Trump administration's attack on naturalization and citizenship?
Yes, I think that it would be great to have those of you that are interested in this issue join our efforts to fight these attacks on naturalization and immigration. As Eric talked about, the proposal around the fee rule and the elimination of the fee waiver, it's a proposed rule, so there are opportunities to comment, and the ILRC will be commenting and submitting comments, and our partners will also, and so there's an opportunity to do that, and the more that the government hears from folks that are opposed to the rule, the longer it might be delayed or even influence it to be changed. And then, of course, we have a wonderful communications team that is always sharing content on social media, so it would be great for folks to check out our content and also share it with your networks. And then, you know, as we approach 2020, and we just have to remember to really interrogate and ask tough questions of our candidates and to make sure that we understand their views on immigration and that they feel in alignment with how we feel. And that's a real important opportunity in pushing back.
Yeah, that's all great. And I think we'll also post a template that one of our partners will be writing for those comments so that people from the general public can actually just fill in the template and send it off to the Department of Homeland Security, too. Isn't that right, Samira?
Yes, that's right. And that should be available, within the next few weeks, I think.
Right. So just if any of your questions, feel free to reach out to me or to Cynthia, as well as in a couple of weeks, you can look at our website and our social media. And if you aren't signed up for our social media, please do so. Cynthia can send out how to do that and the links to do that. So what I want to do is just, Sylvia, if I could, open it up for a couple minutes left to see if there are any questions or comments from anyone in the audience. And also, Samira, if you have any last points you want to bring up as well.
Thank you. If you have a question, please press stars and one on your touch-tone phone. If you're using speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one. And we have a question from Maria Iorda Ortiz.
Yes, I have actually two questions. One is for Samira. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Samira, what will happen in the naturalization? If a person is denaturalized, are the derivatives of the families going under the same process? even though they are not citizens, or they might be married to a U.S. citizen afterwards? Is this going to affect the whole family, or just the person that they find guilty of and that they need to punish?
So, Samira, you want me to answer that?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Yeah, Eric, why don't you go ahead and answer that?
Yeah, so I think your question is, if I understand it right, is if I am denaturalized for a specific reason, let's say I committed fraud or something, and your question is if I immigrated my spouse, might or my kids, might they be impacted by my denaturalization? Is that what your question is?
Yeah, that's my question. Because the children might get married later to citizens, and they
right.
might be here
right.
under the and
right.
the wife.
Right.
Well, I don't know. The wife should be punished for whatever reason the spouse had to do what he did. Right? Is this
right.
going to affect the whole family, or is only the person that? These guys find guilty and they need to denaturalize. What is going to be the process with the families?
Right. So it's a complicated legal question, and it can impact the entire family who immigrated through me. So if I helped my wife and my kids immigrate to the United States, and in fact I shouldn't have been a lawful permanent resident in the first place, and therefore I was denaturalized, it could impact their status as well. They wouldn't be punished in the sense of they wouldn't be charged with fraud. It's just that in some instances, their underlying law, green card or their citizenship could be challenged and taken away as well. So it could impact other people in the family in certain instances. Not only
so. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And what was your second question?
Yes, the second is this one. In this denaturalization is not very familiar for immigrants. What people don't know, we don't really know about this, what's going on. We let people know about what's happening, you know, general population about this, so people, I don't know, at least try to not do it, because some people might feel, okay, I'm going to get married to this. I've known people that they get married to U.S. citizens, and then they divorced, and they might go through the same process. And what can we do to tell people, please don't do that? If you're not really in love with a person, if you're gonna just using the marriage, this is fraud, and please don't do it, because now they're doing this. They're taking away their citizenship, even if you're a citizen. How can we let people know in, you know, not legal terms, that in a very easy way, can we do sort of like part of the campaign of the NAC with NAC about naturalization, make this an important part informing people that are applying for citizenship, and to let them know what's going on, because it is so important. It's very important. Can we do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think there are a couple of levels of that. First of all, when organizations in the New Americans Campaign are helping someone apply for naturalization, generally, and I can't speak for every one of them, but our advice is always, if the person whom you're helping is committing fraud, and you know that, they told you that, you know that, that you should tell them the possible problems with that, including you know fraud. You could go to jail, you could be deported, you could get your green card taken away, you could denaturalize. You should tell them all that, and we suggest that lawyers and paralegals in the New Americans Campaign not help the person, because it doesn't help you as an individual worker to help the person commit fraud. Now, obviously, each individual has its own, you know, is going to make her own decision about what to do. But we encourage our partners not to help people commit fraud. That if someone's going to commit fraud, You tell them what the problems are, what could happen. You tell them what the law is. And if they still say, well, I'm going to commit fraud, then we suggest you not help them. And also, lawyers can get in a lot of trouble if they help people commit fraud. So on that level, we try to discourage that. On the level of doing an outreach campaign, we want to be a little careful of frightening legitimate applicants for naturalization from applying. Because part of what the Trump administration is trying to do is trying to scare people away from applying for naturalization, because the people will think, oh, well, I don't know if I did anything wrong. I don't think I did, and no one ever told me I did, but I don't want to be denaturalized. I'm afraid. And so we don't want to discourage people who have good cases from applying for naturalization, which is 99.99% of the people. Almost everybody. I've helped thousands of people through the naturalization process, probably. Well, maybe 1,500. I can't recollect meeting one who didn't deserve naturalization. So, you know, I think it's a tough question you're asking. I think you just have to do it one-on-one and discourage people who committed fraud from applying and from committing fraud. And if you committed fraud, why not just stay with your green card instead of applying for naturalization? Because when you apply for naturalization, you're opening up a Pandora's box to the whole immigration service re-looking at your case. And it's probably better to just stay as a green card holder. So hopefully that answers your question. Operator, if we have time, we can take one or two more questions. Is there anybody else?
No further questions.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for all your support and for listening today. Really, really appreciate it. And, you know, I just want to reemphasize that citizenship is an important part of the foundation of our democracy. And we should all work to ensure that our naturalization process is administered fairly, efficiently, and reasonably. And right now, this administration is not doing that, and we need to keep the pressure on them, and that's what we're doing. Thank you all very much, and have a great rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.